Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on privacy when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. And let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about privacy. And then it's my contention that privacy is available to everybody today. Even George Bush, probably the most public man in the world, has a lot of privacy. I mentioned the last time that when George Bush goes to Iraq, you don't know anything about it in advance. His schedule is very public. That is, his public schedule is very public. His private schedule is very private. You don't know much about your local police chief. If you were to call the police department and ask where some policemen live, they wouldn't tell you. Policemen try to keep, at least from public view, their addresses and telephone numbers. People very commonly in public life have unlisted telephone numbers. If you call George Bush today, you won't get to talk to George. His calls will be screened. Privacy is something that you work at. It isn't something that you go to the store and buy, or you have it in a bottle someplace, or you carry it in your purse. Privacy is something that you personally want to maintain. If you want to have privacy in your monetary affairs, you can't have a bank account. And that's because the bank clerk can look and see your account records in the bank. All of the people that work in the bank have access to those records. Furthermore, all government agencies have access to those same bank records. Furthermore, many of those bank records are going to be on computer that can be gotten from other sources. You could have an insurance policy, for instance, and your medical records are available to the insurance company. Now, you may say, well, what about the doctor client or doctor patient privacy relationship? It's a fiction. It's true that the average Joe Sixpack can't find out about your private medical information or history. You know, maybe the local pastor in the Baptist church couldn't or doesn't know how to find that information out, but you can rest assured that every insurance company in the country has it, and they can get it if they want it. And I mentioned to you there's a computer program out. It was $1,600 and some change, $1,600 bucks. And I don't know if Dirk bought that or not, but all I need is your name, Social Security number, and your birth date. And with those three pieces of information, which you've got out there, boys and girls, every document that you've signed in your life has your name, Social Security number, and birth date on it. You use your birth date just as commonly as pig tracks in a barnyard. Somebody said, what's your birth date? You'd tell them instantly. Now, in recent years, people are becoming more attuned to the dangers of somebody else getting your Social Security number. It's a little more difficult to get your Social Security number, but certainly not impossible. Your employer has it. And your Social Security number is on dozens of documents that you have on file that are in public institutions. Your driver's license, for instance. And other financial institutions have your Social Security number. So it's not difficult to obtain your Social Security number, your birth date, and your name. And with that, those three pieces of information. In fact, the police themselves, they want to know three things. They want to know your name. They want to know your Social Security number and your birth date. And that's the way you're traced. So getting rid of two of those is kind of neat. If you don't use a birth date, I mean, if you stopped today using your birth date, it wouldn't become a non sequitur forever to all sources forever. But in about 5 years, it would. For practical purposes, it would. And the same thing with your Social Security number. Let me give you a little illustration. About 5 years after I closed my bank account at the Bank of Idaho, I went into the bank one day on a lark, and I stopped in to see, you know, what was going on. And there was only one loan officer left in there that I could recognize, and it was Maggie, Margaret Wolfgram. Margaret Wolfgram was her name. And I walked up to her desk, and I said, "Hi, Maggie." And she said, "Well, Mr. Gordon," she recognized me after all those years, 5 years or so. And I said, "I haven't been doing business here at the bank, and I'd like to open an account. What do we need to do?" And she said, "Well, what's your account number?" And I said, "I don't know. It's been so long since I had an account here." She says, "Has it been over a year?" And I said, "Yes." "Oh," she says, "we don't have any records at all." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Well, it costs money to keep those records, and the banks don't keep records for non-customers longer than a year." I said, "How about records that the bank keeps, say, of financial transactions?" She says, "Yeah, the law requires that we keep those for 6 years. And so every year, you know, 6 years back, we keep them, and then 5 years back, 4 years, 3 years, two, until finally they're consumed, and so we don't have any records at all." I said, "Well, gee, that's neat information. Thank you very much." So what happens is if you don't use credit and you don't use bank accounts and you don't use your Social Security number, over time your business transactions disappear. Not every business transaction forever and ever, but most common business transactions just fall off the radar screen. So privacy begins with an opening. It begins with you saying to yourself, "I think I'll start now." And then over a period of time, my Social Security number will become less and less obvious. There's one other important factor. Social Security number is for life. And there is a modality for rescission. Now, a rescission, if you'll go to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, is what you do when you want to terminate a contractual relationship with your government. If you don't want to do business with a driver's license, marriage license, and so on, you rescind it. You have to give formal notice, tell the other side, I'm not going to use these benefits anymore. Now, there's an important factor as a matter of life and law. You've heard me say, you know, don't say anything, keep your mouth shut and shut up. It's a biblical phrase for all lawyers to remind their clients and students that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And a guy one time say, well, I didn't furnish any evidence for the camera at the bank. Excuse me, partner. Was that you that walked into the bank? Or was it somebody else that was on the camera, on the tape? when you walk into the bank and the bank has a camera up there, I can readily understand that you didn't put the camera up there and you didn't put the tape in there, but you walked into the bank. So the evidence that the bank has of your entering their bank on their film and on their camera was furnished by you because you walked into their bank. Son, if you hadn't walked into the bank, they wouldn't have your picture on their camera. So when a bank robber goes in and robs a bank, he furnishes the evidence because he walked into the bank and robbed it. Now, a lot of times I get, I wouldn't say hate mail, but I get a contradictory mail when somebody says, you know, you're an anarchist, you're a tax protester, you're over here trying to stir up a crime. You know? Not at all. 15% of the people locked up in prison today are innocent. They didn't do what they were convicted for. 15%. 85% are guilty as hell, and they probably belong in jail. And I'm not here to defend the 85%. I'm here to defend the 15% that ought not to be there. Now, just recently, a very top-notch case just came to light. We call it the Duke University lacrosse team case. And there's four players on the Duke team, and I don't even know what the hell lacrosse is, but it's some kind of a game that kids play. And they have a team there, and I guess they play in intercollegiate sports. And four of these members had a wild orgy party. So they're not exactly innocent, but they've got this wild orgy party. And as an outgrowth of it, they're charged with raping two black girls that were nude dancers or something that came to the party. If those lacrosse players had been black or Hispanic, they would be in prison today. There's just a little doubt in my mind that that would happen. The prosecutor was so far off base in the prosecution that even the exculpatory confessions of the two women would not deter him from prosecuting these four white, wealthy young men. Their families had money, and they went out and hired legal counsel. And the legal counsel went out, and they got the confessions and the evidence that these guys were innocent. Now, when you're poor, you don't have those kinds of resources. And you can't hire private detectives, and you can't spend the money that's necessary to prove that you're innocent. So a prosecutor has the edge going in. He has unlimited funds. He has the police department to do all of his legwork for him. And the policemen are specifically trained to get information out of people, whether the information is true or false. And a lot of times the police will find exculpatory evidence. That means evidence that would prove or show or tend to indicate that the defendant is innocent. And they will suppress that. And then they will manufacture evidence. Let me give you an illustration of manufactured evidence here. Let's suppose that you're a woman and you've been raped. And this is a traumatic experience. And you're just mad as hell. And so you go to the police and you report the rape. So let's suppose they send you to the hospital and they find a sperm in you and they take samples of it and they find out, yep, that's right. And so they start looking for some guy that's probably the candidate who raped you. And so they'll take your information, as sketchy as it may be, and they'll go out and they'll round up a bunch of guys that are former rapists. Guys that have been convicted for rape or somebody they suspect might have done it for whatever reason. Then they come in with these five or six or eight rapists over here, and they line them up in a rogues gallery show over here, the lineup they call it. And so they come in and they say, okay, well now which one of these guys raped you? And so you look at these eight guys, and maybe it was late at night, and you know the guy was tall, so there's three tall guys out of the eight. And so that eliminates the short guys, doesn't it? So of the three tall guys that are in there, you're looking at these three guys, and it was dark, and you can't quite, but one of them, you know, looks like, well, maybe he could be. And so you're not quite sure, and you say, well, maybe it's number one, but maybe it could be number six, and maybe it might be number eight, and I can't quite tell. So the police now are in a quandary. They get a crime. It's been reported in the press. They got a job to do. They've got to find this guy. And so they bring you back, and they say, now, listen, based upon the information that you gave us, it indicates to us that it's number 8. This number 8 over here, he's been convicted for rape before. And we think it's number 8. And we want you to take a good close look at number 8 and see if that's him. Now, this is an independent observation on your part. Now there's a subliminal message over here. Well, the police believe it's number 8. I can't quite be sure which one it is because it was so dark at night and I was so traumatized. So you go back and you take a look at number 8, and by golly, that guy's looking more familiar all the time. And so you're still not quite sure that it was number 8, and so you're a little hesitant, you know, to point the finger at somebody. And pretty soon the police say, listen, lady, you made a police report. And, you know, we're going to prosecute you and put you in jail for filing a false police report. Now, you better go back in there and take another look at those guys. And so now you're traumatized again by the police. And so faced with, oh, my God, if I don't identify one of these guys, the police are going to charge me with a crime. And so you go back and you take a look again, and the police assure you that they're pretty damn confident that it's number 8. And so you look at number 8, and this guy's getting more familiar every time you look at him. And pretty soon you identify number 8. So the police take number 8 out of the line and say, well, you've been positively identified, partner. And so what we're going to do here, we're going to prosecute you and put you in prison for 30 years unless you confess. Now, if you'll confess to this rape, why, we will we'll be big guys, and we'll recommend, the prosecutor will recommend that you serve 5 or 10 years, and you'll be out in the street again. Faced with 5 years in prison versus 30 years in prison, faced with this woman who's an eyewitness and three policemen that are positive that you did it over here, they keep working on you. Pretty soon they start talking to you. And so you're trying to tell them, I didn't do it. And so you talk and you talk and you talk. And every time you talk, everything that you say is being written down. It's being tape recorded. And in any conversation, I don't care, you could be talking about fishing or whatever it is, if you talk about something for an hour and you repeat it over and over again, there's going to be little discrepancies in the story. It could be in the time. You know, you went fishing at 10 o'clock. Well, then the next time you tell the story, it was about 10:30 or 11. And then it was sometime in the morning. And then pretty soon, you know, somebody confronts you with the fact that, you know, one time you tell us it's 10 o'clock, and the next time you tell us it's 10:30, and then the next time you tell us it was sometime in the morning. And, of course, this crime occurred at a certain time. And so these little discrepancies, the truth of the matter is it was in the morning, but you don't know what time it was. You don't remember. And as they keep pressing you, you keep trying to come up to please them. You keep trying to come up with a time. Pretty soon you give them a time. Well, it was about 11:15. And now you started at 10. It was 10:30. Now it's 11:15. And pretty soon it's obvious that you don't intend to lie, but your story isn't straight. And confronted with this discrepancy in your story over the time. And then pretty soon it's the place. And then pretty soon it's who was with you. And then pretty soon. And you've got this story that's all over the place. You're traumatized also, especially if you've just been arrested. And so the police trained and geared to look for all of these discrepancies in your story, start putting this together, and then they confront you with it. You're lying. Pretty soon you get to the point where you say, well, I think I'll confess. Now, these are what we call forced confessions. This is what Miranda is designed to avoid. And this kind of tactic goes on, and as a result of it, we have about 15% of people that are convicted are actually innocent. In fact, it's worse than that in rape cases. It's 30%. 30% of all the people that are in prison for rape are innocent. And these four Duke lacrosse players were innocent. And had it been an ordinary prosecution, had it been that these young men had come from normal, ordinary families rather than wealthy families and didn't have the resources, that prosecutor would have had his way and he'd still have his job and he would have convicted these four innocent guys and that would have been the end of it. And if you think that that's an anomaly, that goes on all the time. Rodney King, you know, the black guy that was beaten up in Los Angeles. Listen, the police beat up on people night and day. The Supreme Court in Miranda said there's 40,000 police agencies in the country, and 40,000, we expect one civil rights crime in every one of those agencies once every day. Now, did Texas take 40,000 from the Supreme Court of the United States? 40,000, that's their number, times 365 days a year is 14,600,000 crimes committed by the police. Hell, there's only 14,200,000 crimes committed by the criminals, for crying out loud. The police commit more crimes against people than the criminals commit against people in this country. Now, there's got to be a logical solution to this. And so, Carl F. Warden, I suspect he's probably an attorney, be my guess. And this comes from www.federalobserver.com. TheFederalObserver.com. It's an article on Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment is a privacy amendment. The First, the Fourth, and the Fifth Amendments are privacy amendments. Our founding fathers were concerned about crime, but they were particularly concerned about government crime. Particularly concerned about government crime. Crimes committed by the king against the people. Crimes committed by the nobility against the people. Crimes committed by the military forces against the people. That was their primary concern. Today, Americans are not concerned about government crime against the people. The government has focused our attention on crime that is committed by people against people. That is, rapists against women. And the government comes in and says, you need to be protected from those rapists. Now, ladies, your government, that is, your founding fathers in the Constitution of the United States, provided a protection mechanism. It's called the Second Amendment, your right to keep and bear arms. Women who carry guns in their purses aren't raped. Well, they're not raped very often. There was a test done down in Dade County, Florida, some years back, and back in the 70s, I believe. They went down there and they armed 9,000 women out of a population of 2 or 3 million. Just 9,000 women. Publicized it all over. Had 9,000 women running around on the streets of Miami with guns in their purses. The rape rate, which was running one a day, 365 a year, dropped to, I think if I remember the numbers right, one a month, 12. In communities where people keep and bear arms, crime is low or lower than it is in areas where people are disarmed, like Washington, D.C. I mean, it's just a statistical fact. And the government keeps hammering gun control, gun control, gun control. They do it in the media. They use the media constantly. Gun control, gun control. If we had more gun control, we'd have less crime. Hell, we've got more gun control than we've ever had in our lives in this country, and we got more crime than ever before. When we had less gun control, we had less crime. The more gun control we get, the more crime we get. And government fosters that crime through policy. And for the express people of people, express purpose of people control. All right, now let's try this. Carl Warden gives us some insight on contact with the police. Now, you know, I'm a citizen, and I have contact with the police. I run a law school, and it's often that the FBI comes by. We have conversations. We have the FBI's telephone number, and we talk from time to time. And my local sheriff, you know, calls me from time to time. You know, I'm a member of the Ozark County community. So we have contact with the police from time to time, but you know, when I go and talk to the police, I talk to them about police business. I don't talk about my personal life, my personal business. And if the policeman asks me a question, you know, or the prosecutor or somebody says, you know, how much money do you make? What in the hell has that got to do with the price of putty? That sounds like you're probing for an income tax investigation to me. So, let's take a look at what Carl Warden says. He says, I've debated writing this article for months, and I'm a strong supporter of law enforcement. And I have an extensive background in law enforcement. Even now, I have a number of conflicts which cause me great concern with how the information that I'm about to impart to you is going to be used. I don't want to enable the criminals in our society to thwart justice. but I'm committed to protecting the innocent from what appears to be an explosion of police abuse. And in a case like this, I choose to protect the citizens. So let me start with law enforcement contacts with regard to traffic stops for suspicion of driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs. The Fifth Amendment of the Bill of Rights states that we are not to be forced to incriminate ourselves. The actual wording is that you cannot be compelled to be a witness against yourself. If you are stopped for suspicion of DUI, these are your rights, regardless of the laws of your state. First of all, you are to deny having consumed any alcoholic beverages whatsoever. You are never to admit to having one or two drinks. If you admit to consuming even one drop of alcohol, you open the door to probable cause, allowing the police officer to search your car for open containers. Next, you're never to submit to a field sobriety test. You are to refuse to do so. They cannot make you walk the line. They cannot make you balance or anything else. Now, when you are arrested, you are to refuse to allow a blood or breath test, regardless of what state law requires, such as revocation of driving privileges for a period of time. That's an attempt to compel you to be a witness against yourself. Supreme Court decisions in this area are very specific with regard to your rights as follows. Lefkowitz versus Turley. And the Fifth Amendment provides that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. The Fifth Amendment not only protects the individual against being involuntarily called as a witness against himself in a criminal prosecution, but also privileges him from not answering official questions put to him in any other proceeding, civil or criminal, formal or informal, where the answers might incriminate him in future criminal proceedings. Now, McCarthy versus Arnstein squarely held that the privilege is not ordinarily dependent upon the nature of the proceeding in which the testimony is sought or is to be used. It applies alike to civil and criminal proceedings. Wherever the answer might tend to subject a criminal responsibility to him who gives it. The privilege protects a mere witness as fully as it does one who is partly or a party defendant. Manus versus Myers. And where the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is involved, this court has always construed its protection to ensure that an individual is not compelled to produce evidence which later may be used against him as an accused in a criminal action. The protection does not merely encompass evidence which may lead to criminal conviction, but includes information which would furnish a link in the chain of evidence that could lead to prosecution, as well as evidence which an individual reasonably believes could be used against him in a criminal prosecution. Hoffman versus United States. In Castigar versus United States, we recently reaffirmed the principle that the privilege against self-incrimination can be asserted in any proceeding, civil or criminal, administrative or judicial, investigatory or adjudicatory. Now, let me pause right there, put my famous mark in the margin, and give you a friendly reminder here at the halfway point in the program. And we'll be back with more on this thing of privacy right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to these authors, but the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour, they may be hostile or political, secular, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, we're talking about privacy and three amendments to our Constitution. The first, the fourth, and the fifth are privacy amendments. They deal with this thing called privacy. And the Fifth Amendment's pretty important part of your legal education here. And that is, the police use tactics. And they capitalize on the fact that you've been divorced from your Constitution and Bill of Rights. Divorced in the public education system, you probably learned nothing about them. Anything you know about them, you read in the newspaper, Uncle Tom or Aunt Bessie told you about it. But, you know, generally speaking, the average American is a constitutional illiterate. He's a biblical illiterate, and he's a constitutional illiterate, complaining about why it is he's lost his rights. Now, your rights are lost not because somebody took them from you, but because you're unable to claim them. And I pointed this out earlier, that Judge Schmidt, when he gave me my civics lesson in jurisprudence, he said, "How many rights do you have, Gordon?" And I articulated about 10. He was surprised. He said, "That's really good. Most people, if I ask them how many rights have you got, they can name one or two, maybe. You've got 8 or 10 there. That's pretty good. You have about 1,100. So I'm going to repeat to you what Judge Schmidt told me. He went to law school, and I didn't. And he said, you get about 1,100 rights that you could articulate if you knew what they were. But none of them are available to you unless you can claim them. So here's your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Now, if you can remain silent, you can claim your Fifth Amendment right. If you can't remain silent, you just have to talk. Well, then you can't claim your Fifth Amendment right. And anything that you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. All right, now the policeman's supposed to warn you about that. The policeman's supposed to say you've got a right to counsel. This is when he arrests you. But you see, before he arrests you, he can ask you questions. And if you will give him the answers that he's asking, then he can use that evidence against. Just try it. The policeman stops you, and he comes up to the window, and, "Good evening, and how's everything going? Hey, I notice you're weaving a little in your lane over here. Have you been drinking?" "Well, yeah, I had a couple of beers, but I'm not drunk." That's all he needs. There's the probable cause right out of your mouth. You admitted that you've been drinking. Now the question is, well, how much have you been drinking? If the same policeman comes up and asks you the question, "Have you been drinking?" Now, you have been, but you don't want to lie. So you say, "I haven't been drinking. I have consumed no alcohol." And this triggers your conscience. You go, "Oh, my God, I'm lying to the policeman." Boys and girls, I've been in the legal business for 25 years. I only met one policeman that ever got on the witness stand and told the truth. One. His name was John DeLeonard. It was such a shock to me. I still remember the guy's name. He got on the witness stand and started asking him questions, and he told the truth. That's one policeman. Policemen don't tell the truth when they get on the witness stand. Now, that doesn't mean that they lie. You ask a policeman 10 questions, he answers 9 of them truthfully and tells one lie. And the one lie convicts you. And one of the lies is going to be, well, did you give this guy's Miranda warning? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I did. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. What was your probable cause? Oh, he was weaving in his own lane. No, you weren't. He's lying. That's what he needed to make the stop. Then after he made the stop on this phonied up probable cause argument, he found that you didn't have a driver's license. Now, again, you know, there are rules that need to be followed, and the police need to follow the rules. If we're going to have freedom, liberty, if we're going to have privacy, then everybody has to follow the rules. Citizens have to be responsible members of society, and police have to be responsible enforcers of the law. What we've got here is a citizenry that's irresponsible and a police force that's almost equally irresponsible. Dedicated, sincere, but irresponsible. Beating up on Rodney King isn't responsible. And one crime in every police department in America once a day is not responsible. Bottom line. So, in Miranda versus Arizona, decided back in 1966, we have recently noted that the privilege against self-incrimination, the essential mainstay of our adversary system, and I'm going to underline the adversary system, and I'm going to make a comment here. The Bible has a justice system, and we used to follow the Ten Commandments and the justice system. And the justice system says we would rather turn a guilty party free than to convict an innocent man. Well, we changed that about 1900, about the time we got this Federal Reserve program in and so on. We, for some reason, I don't know why, but, you know, for some reason, Americans decided the justice system wasn't near as good as the adversarial system of the foreigners and the nations around us. And so we have adopted the Roman civil law in place of the Mosaic law. Whether it's good or bad or right or wrong, I'm not here to judge it. It's been done, past tense. We have what's known as the adversarial system. It's a contest. It doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you're guilty. It has to do with whether or not I'm a good enough lawyer to convict you. And you damn well better be a good enough lawyer to defend yourself and to defeat me, because my job as the prosecutor is to lock you up. And whether or not you did it or not is irrelevant. Can you understand that? The prosecutor in this case against the four members of the lacrosse team, he knew they were innocent. He had the evidence. But, you know, he'd already had them arrested. And from his training and from his experience as a prosecutor, my job is to convict them. And he set about to do just that. Is that right? Well, I don't think it is, but then, you know, I don't make these rules. I don't make these laws. I'm just an observer on the scene reporting. And so here's the author. He says, our adversarial system. Well, that's what we've degenerated into. It's an adversarial system. Policeman, you know, when I was a kid, a policeman comes up and you've been drinking. Of course, it wasn't against the law to drive drunk, you know, when I was a kid. So, policeman comes up and he sees you're drunk or you're parked alongside the road. Policemen used to be helpful fellas. Hell, I've had policemen take me home for crying out loud. Here, you can't drive. Get in here. I'll take you home. They still do that in a few rural areas here in America. You know, you find a deputy sheriff out here, you catch you out here driving drunk. You say, hey, Bob, for crying out loud, you can't drive, you're too damn drunk. Get in the car here and take you home. And so he'd take you home, and he won't put you to bed, but he'll drop you off there at the front door. Now, today, this is big business. And auto and auto tickets and the police out here on the highways enforcing the traffic laws. In some communities, it's the difference between bankruptcy and solvency is the number of tickets that are written in a particular community to support local government. In fact, it's big business. I'll give you a number here. Old Judge Woods used to be the champion up in Boise, Idaho. It's Ada County. And he did six sessions a day, 9 to 10, 10 to 11, 11 to 12, then take off till 1:30, then work from 1:30 to 2:30, 3:30, and 4:30. And then I'd leave the courthouse, you know, at 5 o'clock. Judge Woods would do one case a minute. Now, that's 45 cases an hour. He only worked 45-minute shifts, and he had a 15-minute coffee break, and then he'd take on the next round. And he would line these people up, five in a line, and Carol, his court clerk over there, would call out five names, and then you'd line up over there, and then the judge would come in, and then they'd read you your rights and one thing and another, and they'd go through the process. And so you'd come up there, and you'd say, well, you've been charged with speeding. And so... what do you got to say for yourself? Well, I'm sorry, Judge, I was speeding and I was guilty as hell and blah, blah, blah. Now, if you pled guilty, see, he'd charge you half price. Maybe the fine for speeding, you know, was $50, but he charged you $25 plus $14 court costs. So, as a court watcher, I used to sit there in court and take notes. And so I'd sit there and take notes. And I'm running to the average fine was $37 with court costs, $25. Dollars plus $14 court costs, and it came out to $37 typically when you do a bunch of them. So take 37 times 45. 37 times 45 people times six sessions a day is $9,990 a day. Now, Judge Woods was raking in about $10,000 a day in his courtroom. They're running three courtrooms. Now, he's the champion. The others are only running something less than that. So let's give them, you know, say half that. The other two guys are slow, and so they can only do half that. That's $20,000 a day. So take $20,000 a day times 5 days a week. That's $100,000 a week times 52 weeks a year. That's $5,200,000 of revenue that comes into Ada County from traffic citations. $5,200,000 a year. This is back in 1980. Now, you know, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of tax revenue. Put another way, if everybody in Ada County obeyed all the traffic laws, never violated any of the traffic laws at any time for any cause or reason for one whole year, Ada County and Boise City would go into bankruptcy. Bottom line. Couldn't pay their bills. So crime is an important element. And these people, these policemen with all the police resources that are out there, they're not interested in rapists, robbers, and murderers. They're interested in seat belts and stop signs and driver's licenses and registrations and whether or not you've got your proof of insurance. Victimless crimes that don't amount to two hoots in a whirlwind don't have anything to do with protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Nothing. Some guy calls me up and he says, well, they keep drunk drivers off the road. Oh, no, no. They don't keep drunk drivers off the road. They fleece the drunk drivers. Before we had drunk driver legislation, we had a system whereby people drove drunk. And some of those drunk drivers killed people. And so people got excited and they said, well, we got to get all the drunks off the road. Well, the drunks only kill about 12,000 people a year. The sober people kill about 30,000. I mean, if you want to protect the driving public, take all the sober drivers off the road for crying out loud. And you'll save three times as many deaths at the end of the year. I mean, come on. Let's wake up. There's another factor that you could plug in here. That blue-eyed drivers kill people. So get all the blue-eyed drivers off the road. Now, I'm not advocating that you drive drunk, but I am pointing this out, that oftentimes the drunk driver isn't the cause of the accident. It's the sober driver, and the drunk driver takes the rap. But it makes an additional $2 billion a year. Drunk driving is a $2 billion a year windfall for the legal profession. That's what it really boils down to. So they got all you people excited, you know, about getting drunk drivers off the highways. It hasn't done anything for the traffic count or the traffic death count over the last 20 or 30 years to speak of. Now, this adversarial system over here is the cause of it. It's a money-making system. The adversarial system makes money. That's the purpose behind it. It's not a justice system. God gave us a justice system, and we gave him the finger and said, now we're going to adopt the Roman system. Well, this adversarial system is founded on a complex of values. To maintain a fair state, individual balance, to require the government to shoulder the entire load, to respect the inviolability of the human personality, our accusatory system of criminal justice demands that the government seeking to punish an individual produce the evidence against him by its own independent labors, rather than by the cruel, simple expedient of compelling it from his own mouth. Now, this is what we're doing in Guantanamo. If you apply enough pain, the guy will confess. And that's un-American. It violates our Fifth Amendment. Well, these guys aren't citizens. Well, okay, well then we can go out and torture all of you other people in the world. In fact, our government today, we go over to Italy, kidnap people off the streets. We kidnap Italian citizens off the street of Italy, send them over to Egypt to be tortured, and take the information so we can use it in Iraq. Done every day. You know it, and I know it. The Congress knows it, and the President knows it, and everybody knows it around the world. And I deplore it. It's criminal. The problem isn't with the criminals on the street. It's the criminals in government, for crying out loud, that are doing that. Now, in sum, the privilege is fulfilled only when the person is guaranteed the right to remain silent unless he chooses to speak in the unfettered exercise of his own free will. So if a guy wants to confess, he can. If he doesn't want to confess, shut up and go out and get the evidence against him. And so the police now are trained to get the evidence from you, not by force and violence, although that happens from time to time, but rather to do it subtly. To trick you. Which is why I always tell my students, I say, you know, if you can't keep your mouth shut, you can't do this. I always tell them, you know, if you're going to play the justice system and you can't go to jail, you can't do this. A lot of people, you know, they're claustrophobic. They can't handle being locked up in jail. So the policeman knows that, so he locks you up. He can lock you up for, in this state, it's 22 hours. So they lock you up on Friday so they can keep you Saturday, Sunday, and then they bring you up to arraignment on Monday so they can keep you over the weekend. And so by the time you've been in jail for a couple of days, you know, if you're a novice at this and you get locked up for a couple of days, and of course the police are working on you psychologically and they're saying, you're never going to let you out of here. We're going to keep you locked up in here forever. You've taken your last free breath, sucker. Well, unless you cooperate with us, tell us what we want to know. So, you know, most people under those circumstances, they'll spill their guts. Hell, they'll confess to something that they don't even know how to do to get out of jail. Or just for the promise of getting out of jail. Now, there can be no doubt that the Fifth Amendment privilege is available outside of criminal court proceedings and serves to protect persons in all settings in which their freedom of action is curtailed in any significant way from being compelled to incriminate themselves. So you ask the policeman, am I free to go? And he says, no. Okay. You're in custody. Shut up. What's your name? I don't want to talk without my attorney present. Now, sometimes, I had one cop one time tell me, he said, well, we'll bring a lawyer in here. I said, good, I want F. Lee Bailey. So, guy says, well, you can't have F. Lee Bailey. Well, who am I going to get? You're going to get the public defender. So I don't want the public defender. He said, well, then you're denying, you're refusing counsel. Oh, no. I'm not refusing counsel. I'm just not going to accept your lawyer, partner. Now, what the hell kind of thing is this? Let's take this on. Think about it for a minute. You sue me, and you and I have a bitch, you know, with one another, and so we're in litigation over here. And I come over to you and I say, here, I'm going to give you my lawyer. go ahead and you tell my lawyer whatever it is. He'll defend your side of the case too. Save you the time, effort, and energy. What would you think of that? Well, if you're sitting there saying that's insane, excuse me, but the public defender works for the state. The policeman works for the state. Can you explain to me what the difference is when the policeman says, hey, let me give you my lawyer, spill your guts to him? Huh? You think the public defender is working for defendants, for crying out loud? Ask the public defender. Just test it. Ask the public defender, how many criminal cases have you ever won as a public defender? I asked that one time of Larry Richards, and he said to me, it's not the job of the public defender to win his client's case. I was so shocked. If I'd had false teeth, it'd have been on the floor. I said, well, what is his job? And he said to me, now note this down, boys and girls, the public defender of Ada County said to me, he said, the public defender's job is to protect his client's rights at every stage of the proceeding. That's legalese for, in plain language, it means if the public defender succeeds in doing his job, he will have eliminated every appealable error from every proceeding for which you will have absolutely no appeal. And your conviction will stick and you will spend the full term in prison. That's the public defender's job, to make sure that you spend the full time in prison. I asked Larry Richards, I said, did you ever win a case as a public defender? And he said, no. In 6 years as the public defender, with an average caseload of 28 clients, never won one single case. The public defender's job is to get you to plead guilty. And they make you neat deals. You know, if you're faced with, let's say, 30 years in prison on a rape charge, and your public defender comes in and he persuades you to plead guilty in a plea bargain when you only spent 5 years in prison, he counts that as a success. Whether you're guilty or innocent, it's irrelevant. Jesus, I got you off of 25 years. Wouldn't it have been his job to come in and prove that you were innocent? Shouldn't the prosecuting attorney, when he has the evidence that you're innocent, dismiss the charges against you? But see, he won't do that, because under our adversarial system, you can then sue the prosecutor and or the police and or the state or county for false arrest and false imprisonment. So to protect them from lawsuits, they will put you in prison even if you're innocent. Nothing personal, you know, it's just business. So let's get on to... Okay, now have you got that? You should also know, there can be no doubt that the Fifth Amendment privilege is available outside of criminal court proceedings and serves to protect persons in all settings in which their freedom of action is curtailed in any significant way from being compelled to incriminate themselves. So whether it's a traffic stop, or you're walking down the street, or the police just knock on your door. You should also note the above is stated by the Supreme Court are rights and privileges as guaranteed by the Constitution. Anyone, including judges, who knowingly violate these rights may be civilly and criminally liable under several federal statutes. Title 18, Section 241, Section 242, Deprivation of Rights, Title 42, Section 1983, 1986 Civil Rights Act. Most attempts to pursue action under these laws fail. But very skilled litigators with good factual circumstances can sometimes get some satisfaction. However, if more individuals were to understand the above rights and exercise them at the appropriate times, more successful litigation could be the outcome. I teach a class here on civil rights. For all you policemen out there, it's free. I've often said over the years, if you're a policeman, a prosecutor, if you're a public official and you want to come to my civil rights class, I'll teach you the Constitution and the civil rights of individuals free of charge. It didn't cost you anything. And if you're a citizen or you're an individual out here you want to protect yourself and you want to make sure that you don't get locked up, one of those 15% of the innocent, the civil rights class is the place to go.
And that's because if you don't know what your rights are, you sure as hell can't claim them. That's what old Judge Smith said. You know, you can't claim a right that you don't know exists. Now, you've got 1,100 rights, America. 1,100. That's a bunch. Not a single one of them is available to you, unless you know what it is. So that means that you've got to know where to go to find these rights, and that's called legal research. You know, you want to know what the police can and can't do at a traffic stop. You know, your state statutes say, you know, if you don't submit to this field sobriety test, we're going to take your driver's license away from you. Boys and girls, you can't punish somebody for exercising a constitutional right. But driving is a privilege. But you got a right to the privilege. And you can't be compelled to confess to a crime. The Constitution is superior to state statutes. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking, no legislation which would abrogate them. Do we have unconstitutional laws on the books? Everywhere in the law books, there are unconstitutional laws. Does that impair law enforcement? Not at all. The policeman goes out and enforces unconstitutional laws. An unconstitutional law is an illegality. They do it every day. Why? Tell the people that they're doing it to don't know the difference. Don't blame the policeman for violating your rights. At some point in time, you've got to say, hey, Mr. Policeman, you're violating my rights. It's up to you to tell him. It's an adversarial position. The policeman against you. He's not your friend. If you think that the policeman's your friend, you got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy again. The policeman is your adversary. It's not supposed to be that way. And it wasn't always that way. When we practiced the Ten Commandments, the policeman was our friend in a judicial system. A justice system. Today, we have a monetary system. Not a judicial system, it's money. As old Dan Rather used to say, follow the money. And it's an adversarial system. And the policeman's job is to get the goods on you and convict you. So that we can fine you and make money. He's a revenue agent. Nothing more, nothing less. And he's there to protect the claims window of the insurance industry. That's why he insists that you have your seatbelt fastened. Whether or not you wear a seatbelt doesn't make a rat's rectum to me one way or the other, or you or anybody else. But it does to the insurance industry. And the policeman is out there to protect the insurance industry. He's not out there to protect you. As soon as you get that through your head, you'll be one step closer to privacy. Yeah, I'm running out of time again, so I got to give you a reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.